meeting doesn't know
if he can get in early.
So I'm hoping he's going to be on time.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Welcome to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd, and we are really excited about our show this evening. I'm here with my co-host, Kurt McKenzie, tonight, and I'm hoping that Red Beckman is online. Red, are you there? Well, Kurt, I will open us with prayer, if it's all right with you.
Sure, that's fine.
Father in heaven, we just come before you humbly tonight, asking you to show us the truth tonight, to bring it out and to put your spirit ahead of us and make our words such that people will understand and grasp what we're trying to say. And we pray that everything that we do here in this show is in accordance with your will. And we're just thankful for the guests we have tonight, Father, and we're especially thankful for my friend Red and my friend Kurt, and especially for Dr. Kate. And we're just thankful for the opportunity to bring a message forward that will benefit everyone that's listening. It's in the name of your son, Yeshua, that we pray. Amen. Kurt, how would you like to introduce our first guest tonight?
Well, Karen Budd Follin is a woman I just recently became familiar with through the Defend Rural America launch in Waiweka, California, and I've had a chance subsequently to have a few conversations with her, and I'm thoroughly impressed, Karen. I think she's kind of like the Jerry Spence, I think, of rural America. I mean, I'm really impressed so far, and I was anxious to have her on the show, and I'm glad that she's put the time into it. Karen, perhaps you could start off by telling us a little bit about yourself, your practice, and maybe a little background on how you got to doing what you're doing.
Certainly. I am glad to be with you. I am here from Cheyenne, Wyoming, where my husband and I have a law practice that focuses on property rights, on protecting rural communities, and standing up for the Constitution. I tell people that I really was born into the practice of protecting property rights and ranchers because I grew up as a fifth-generation rancher on a family ranch in western Wyoming.
Karen, could I jump in for just 1 second? It's a little hard to hear. Sometimes I hear you loud, and then most of the time I hear you soft.
Okay, let me see what I can do.
That sounds good right there. Whatever you're doing sounds great.
Okay.
Okay, so sorry for the interruption, but I want to make sure that all the listeners can hear. So go ahead.
All right, so I got my law degree from the University of Wyoming. I spent some time in Washington, D.C., working for the Reagan administration when Jim Watt was Secretary of the Interior, and Washington was just too big and too crowded and too bureaucratic, so after 3 years I left, came back to Wyoming, and my husband and I and the people we practiced with are working very hard to keep people on the land and on their ranches and rural community supporting America.
Well, I think that the thing I guess you've been doing this for a very long time and are really dedicated to it. If I recall, you became a lawyer because of an effort to try and protect your family's own ranch.
Yes, the joke was that when my sisters and I were born, my father said I need a lawyer, a veterinarian, and a banker to keep this ranch in business, and that's what he got out of my sisters and I.
That's great. Got a full house there. Well, listen, the first thing we'll talk about is the fact that in this whole rural America, saga, I guess, war might be a more accurate word, is that it seems like the kind of the radical, and I mean they're really radical, the extremist environmentalists. I don't know what to call them. They're not really environmentalists per se, almost like anti-Americans in their vitriol and their attack on people's homes and private property and so forth. Their views are just really extreme. But they always seem to have an unending, if they can't get it their way through any other process, they seem to have this unending ability to raise money to fund lawsuits and then use the lawsuits to stop things they don't want. And a cumulative effect of these lawsuits seems to almost be forcing the agencies into certain policies that are contrary to the interests of the local communities in rural America. So it's in the context of tonight's topic is to understand how one of these things is, how are they doing this? And so if you would, talk a little bit about the Equal Access to Justice Act.
Certainly, I'd be happy to. The Equal Access to Justice Act, quite honestly, has been hijacked by very radical, what they call environmentalists, but who are really not, because they don't care at all about the environment. They simply care about making more money. And this act has been hijacked because the federal government is paying these groups to sue the federal government to stop people and their use of their property rights and their use of the land. And the act has been in place since Ronald Reagan signed it in the 1980s. The problem is that the act has been reinterpreted and changed. And now you have the Justice Department not even requiring compliance with the act. Rather, you have millions of dollars being sent from the federal coffers to these environmental groups. And the most shocking thing to me is the money is not tracked. You cannot go anywhere to the Justice Department or to the Department of Treasury and find out how much money is paid in, quote, reimbursement of attorney fees to any single group. That money hasn't been tracked since 1995.
Yeah, let's come back to that. Why don't you kind of fill in the listeners a bit on trying to understand what was the original intent of this act and what were some of the mechanisms built in that were designed to kind of keep it focused on exactly what the original intent was?
Sure. The original reason this act was even introduced was because, as everyone knows, sometimes the federal bureaucracy makes bad decisions. They make decisions that have no justification, either in fact or in law, but because they are the Goliath, sometimes David has to go to protect his rights. And so what Congress believed was that if you are a small individual or a businessman, if your net worth is less than $7 million and you have to sue the federal government because the federal government is not justified in what it's doing to you, you should be able to recuperate the amount of money you spent. And so the whole purpose was to put people back in the same position that they were before they had to sue the federal government. And it's very difficult to sue the federal government. They're represented by the Justice Department, which is the largest law firm in the world. They have absolutely unlimited resources. And so Congress and President Reagan thought that if you sue the federal government and you win and your net worth is less than $7 million, that you should be able to recuperate the amount of money that you paid to your attorney. This was not a get-rich scheme. If you look at the legislative history, it talks about we are going to support minority litigants, we're supporting small businesses, we're supporting individuals who are trying to right a wrong from the bureaucracy. And that has not been how that act has been interpreted for the last approximately 15 years.
Okay, so we have a couple things in there. So first off, it's only for individuals net worth below $7 million. And secondarily, they have to win, and then they get to recoup attorney fees. And if I recall our prior discussion, there were some limits on the amount of attorney fees.
Well, there's actually two more pieces in there. The first piece is that not only do you have to win, you have to show that the government's position was not justified. Basically, you have to show that the bureaucracy knew it was wrong, but was simply pushing its weight around anyway. And so it wasn't just that you won in a fair fight. It was that the government was absolutely wrong. The other limitation in there is that you could only recoup $125 an hour because they simply wanted to put you back in the same place as before, not to make additional money, not for your attorneys to make additional money. This was really to try to level the playing field between individuals and a government who was abusing its power.
Okay, now step us forward a little bit into the next step that I recall where this starts to change is in some of the, I forget the name of the legislation, but the Paperwork Reduction Act and how things start to shift at that point.
In 1995, Bill Clinton signed the Paperwork Reduction Act. And the purpose of the act was to not spend so much money on paperwork and bureaucracy, which sounded really good. The problem is that one of the pieces of paper that was reduced was any accounting for these attorney's fees paid under the Equal Access to Justice Act. And so since 1995, there has been no accounting of this money. There is no record of where this money gets spent, who spends it, which groups are benefiting from this, how much in attorney's fees are paid, whether the payment is substantially over the $125 an hour. All of that went out the window in 1995. And in the research that we have done, we believe that that's where really the abuse started happening, is after that accounting mechanism and that transparency mechanism went away.
Now, did the Act specifically then exempt or go after this particular aspect of paperwork for the Equal Access to Justice Act?
No, the Act generally said, pardon?
Did it call it out by name, specifically say that's one that we're not going to spend time on?
No, actually what happened was the Act simply said we are going to reduce paperwork across the board, and then governments and departments and the Congress itself went through and started saying, okay, we don't need this. We don't need
that. Okay, we're having a hard time hearing you again. If you're on a speakerphone or something, it might be better to pick up the handset or something. There you're sounding better again.
Hang on a minute. Let me switch this.
Okay.
There, is that better?
Much better.
Okay. I'm sorry, now I've forgotten where we were.
So the Paperwork Reduction Act of 1995, I guess my question was, you're pointing out that act, subsequent to that act, they didn't have to keep track of any of the legal fees being paid out under the Equal Access to Justice Act. Was that specifically in the Paperwork Reduction Act, or did it come in some category where that happened? I mean, in other words, I'm trying to understand whether Clinton or whoever put this legislation together specifically was trying to eliminate the accountability under the Equal Access to Justice Act.
No, sadly, what happened was that the accountability for this act was being handled through the Congressional Research Service, and Congress eliminated this provision.
I see. Okay. Did the act have a consequence? I think most Americans would think that the Paperwork Reduction Act was to streamline things, not eliminate accountability. It's obviously eliminating accountability under the one act here. Is it to eliminate accountability in a broader range of things?
We haven't really looked at that issue because that's not been our focus. In the research that we've done, we were much more focused on looking at the amount of attorney's fees paid before and after to determine if we could see any serious or tangible difference.
Okay, so why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about some of the examples of what you've come up with. I know you've done a lot of research on trying to figure out, where money is going.
Well, it was interesting because you would think that since every federal lawsuit is handled by the Justice Department would be able to tell you who has sued them and how many times and what kind of cases there were, but they can't even do that. We filed numerous Freedom of Information Act requests to try to get this information. The Justice Department would write back and say, we simply do not know. We did get one list of litigants just in the federal district court in Idaho. It turns out that the Justice Department missed counting 23 cases that they defended, that they didn't even get on a list. So the people in my office decided that we wanted to see if this was truly a problem or not. So we spent a couple of months and worked on a database called PACER, which is all of the federal court cases in the nation. We painstakingly went through those in various states, naming individual environmental groups, and what we discovered was that in 9 years, in just considering 19 states and the District of Columbia, for only 13 groups, we found $36 million had been paid. Some of the stories were just horrendous. For example, in one case in California, rather than $125 an hour, the Justice Department agreed to $650 an hour in attorney fees, which I can tell you that in normal practice, that attorneys in environmental cases do not charge $650 an hour to their clients. We found cases where the Justice Department agreed to pay 7 attorneys who wrote one single court brief $500,000. I'm not even sure how 7 attorneys can write a single court brief. And so we started finding these huge abuses. The other thing that we found is that a significant number of these cases, rather than litigating the results, are simply settled. And the Justice Department simply agrees to pay attorney's fees, so there is no determination of whether the government's position was justified or not. The Justice Department just pays the money. And probably the most frustrating thing we found was that if you are a for-profit organization, or you are, for example, a landowner, and your net worth is over $7 million, you cannot receive attorney fees under any circumstances. But if you are a nonprofit organization, no matter what your net worth, you can receive attorney's fees. And so in looking at the IRS documents, we found the Sierra Club, with a net worth of $56 million, can receive attorney's fees. But say a rancher, even though he has no cash at all, if his land is worth $7 million, he cannot qualify for attorney's fees.
So kind of going back to the protections built into the original act, I'm going to kind of do a summary. So one requirement was net worth less than $7 million, but that doesn't apply to nonprofits. There is no limit to nonprofits. Returning fees would be awarded only if there was a win. Now they don't even have an actual trial. They'll do settlements, $125 an hour limit, and you have at least some evidence they're paying us $600 an hour, maybe even more, $500,000 for a brief or some attorneys. So basically the act is being pretty much ignored, and all those mechanisms for protection are being violated. Was the Equal Access to Justice Act specifically amended in any way that would have taken any of these provisions out?
No, it was not.
It was not. Now, who are some of the organizations that are the beneficiaries of this money?
The groups that I have most seriously looked at are what I would term radical environmental groups, groups like the Center for Biological Diversity, the Western Watersheds Project, the Wild Earth Guardians, Sierra Club, National Wildlife Federation, Wilderness Society, all receive money through attorney's fees from the federal government.
And do you have any, you want to give us some examples of exactly how this kind of works in practice?
Well,
how they actually, yeah, go ahead.
For example, if you look at cases, at statutes like the Endangered Species Act, under the Endangered Species Act, there are very strict timelines that the federal government has to comply with. the probably the most strict is that anyone in America can file a petition to list a bug or a bird or a plant or a snake or whatever as a threatened or endangered species, and the Fish and Wildlife Service has to respond to that petition within 90 days. And if they wait till the 91st day, then the group who filed the petition can sue the federal government. The federal government most often settles that litigation and pays attorney's fees. Now, note, the litigation is not over whether the animal is truly threatened or endangered, whether there ought to be protections, whether it ought to be listed. The litigation is simply over the failure of the federal government to comply with the time deadline. Last year, the Center for Biological Diversity initiated a program where it filed 1,000 petitions to list various bugs and birds and worms and moths and all sorts of stuff. There is no way the federal government can comply with responding to 1,000 listing petitions. Even if it wanted to, the federal government can't do it. So every time the federal government misses that deadline, the environmental group sues, and they can be paid attorney's fees. And most often, they file their complaint, and the federal government just says, you're right, we missed the deadline, and we will pay attorney's fees. There's no litigation, no court decision, no judicial review, absolutely nothing.
Now, in this particular case, if I recall correctly, it didn't stop there, correct?
No. In fact, what happened just in the last few months is that the Center for Biological Diversity and another very litigious litigation group, environmental group called the Wild Earth Guardians, had several cases combined into one, what they call multi-species district or multi-district species litigation. The litigation dealt with 100 species who had listing petitions or critical habitat petitions that had not been timely answered by the federal government. So they ended up in court. The federal government settled that case, and not only did it agree to look at the 113 species, it added approximately 900 more, so that in the next 5 years, the federal government's got to look at over 1,000 actions, just simply do the paperwork on the 1,000 actions. That's going to cost the American taxpayer, just to do the paperwork, several hundred thousand dollars, and the government has agreed to pay attorney fees to these two groups for bringing the litigation.
So in some of these situations, I think there's kind of a serial effect. They can actually have two or three lawsuits all in the same matter, correct?
Yes, or more than that.
So they can start with one suing them on the basis of not meeting a 90-day response time, and then they sue on another basis, they sue on another basis, and it's basically they just keep getting money from government and continue to sue the government on the same matter, basically from different aspects.
We've looked at cases regarding, there was a grass species in Idaho. The environmental group sued over that grass species four times and ended up with several hundred thousand dollars in attorney's fees suing over the same grass species four different times.
It's almost like there's a lot, in addition to the environmentalist groups, do we have kind of attorney companies are beginning to specialize this, almost like some do in these, cases where you get everybody to kind of sue together. I mean, it sounds like it's almost becoming a kind of a legal mill for some companies. Would that be true?
Oh, I think it is true. When you look at the 990s for some of these organizations, there are now law firms that specialize in, quote, environmental litigation on behalf of these groups. One group, for example, in Boise, Idaho, called Advocates for the West, admits that it gets somewhere between 60 and 80% of its funding from attorney's fees from the federal government. I've heard those attorneys speak, and they will admit that they don't charge their, quote, clients or, quote, environmental groups anything. They just get reimbursed from from the federal government are, quote, reimbursed, and then they plow that right back into litigation on some other issue. The group that they most often represent is called Western Watersheds Project, and Western Watersheds Project's sole goal is to eliminate livestock grazing on public lands and in rural communities.
So these alliances growing between legal firms on one hand, making a whole ton of money at it, specializing at it, and doing the work, I guess, pro bono, pretty much knowing what the law and how they're going to play the system or game the system, and they know they're going to get money back from the federal government, and them working in conjunction with some of these radical environmental groups.
I think it is a concerted, organized effort. I don't think this was happenstance. I think this was all a very well thought out plan. And until we stop the cycle of money, I think that these kind of things are going to keep happening, and rural America is going to continue to suffer.
Yeah, they're using our money to defeat us. I mean, that's the amazing thing about this. The one thing that was surprising to me in our conversation was the idea that anyone can request a listing. John Doe, Kirk McKenzie, I could go down and I could file, pull out a book on species, and I could sit there and I could file a request on every damn species in North America or United States territory, presumably. Does somebody that requests a listing have to have any evidence whatsoever that the animal is in fact endangered?
No.
And the other interesting aspect of this I learned from you is, I'm beginning to understand, the Endangered Species Act generally has been portrayed to the public, and it's certainly my understanding. We're talking about species that are about to go extinct. And I have really learned through the event in Siskiyou County, what's going on up there with the coho salmon. We're not talking about a species that's going extinct at all. It's doing quite well, and it's growing in a lot of different places, but the definition of this is being changed, but the language is being left in place to give the people the feeling that you're still talking about extinction. Either you jump in and have these emergency powers or the thing will go extinct. What is the definition now of that allows an animal to be listed?
There are a couple of parts to that question. Probably the most important thing that the public needs to understand is that a species can be listed and the federal government has no idea how many of that species there are. There's no requirement to go out and actually count or catalog or note how many animals or how many plants that there are of a species. Rather, what the federal government is required to do is basically a literature search. And that literature search will tell them one of two things. It will either tell them that somebody believes that there used to be more animals now or more animals in the past than there are now, and that can be over any time period. That's one basis to list it. And the second basis to list it, and the Obama administration is now proposing this as a new policy, is to say that if they believe that the habitat is shrinking, even if the numbers of the animals or bugs or whatever is on the increase, they can still list the species. And so you have listing petitions for things like the buffalo, which there is no question that there is less buffalo habitat now than there was back then, back when the Indians were here before the settlers came. There was no Cheyenne, there was no Denver, and I'm sure buffalo roamed these areas. And under the new definition, the buffalo would be listed, even though there's as many animals as there were back then, but because there's less, quote, available habitat.
And I think part of that definition, as I understand it, is it basically has been shifted to the idea that somehow every species has to be roughly in comparable numbers where it was historically, and there has to be sufficient habitat for that species in that particular area, which almost predetermines the outcome of reverting the country back to wilderness before, man steps foot on, except perhaps for the Indian tribes. I mean, if you essentially list the buffalo, and I understand from listing buffalo, it also means that you have to have sufficient habitat for the buffalo, and we're talking about buffalo where they used to range, have to be in the same numbers on the same habitat. You're talking about the destruction of farms and, you know, the recreation of these open plains where the buffalo rode free. It seems to me that's the predetermined outcome by the way they're now interpreting the definition of an endangered species.
Well, I think it is, and I think that you're going to see that even being carried to farther extremes simply because of the bureaucratic interpretation. And the other problem you have, and it was admitted in articles by the Center for Biological Diversity, is that the CBD uses litigation not as a tool for a legal end, but to get greater bargaining power for issues that it believes in. And so these really radical environmental groups, quite honestly, don't care whether there's buffalo out here or don't care where the buffalo roam. What they're trying to do, in fact, the CBD states that what it's trying to do is demoralize federal employees so that they will do what the Center for Biological Diversity wants them to do.
And what
because
do you think is their ultimate?
Just do again and again.
And what do you think? Do you have any feeling of yourself what their ultimate goal is?
Well, based on their recent campaign, first, it's population control. They want to see the citizens with limited population numbers only living in very specific areas. And so people in rural America, the people that grow the food and fiber for this country, the people that do the mining, people that generate the energy, we would all be moved into these areas so that you have connectivity between wildlands and wilderness areas, so that you have a open mosaic that only certain people could visit, I'm assuming, you know, members of the environmental groups. Now, where they think our food and fiber and energy is going to come from, I'm not exactly sure, but I believe that that is their ultimate goal. It's not the population, it's the control of people.
So, yeah, and it's almost inevitable when you consider, you look at the Wilderness Project and what it's intended to do. Exactly what you're saying is you take these areas, and I think they're doing it strategically. They're going after, you know, water in specific areas. They're going after energy sources. They're going after, you know, certain prime real estates, but there's probably gold or silver or something still left there. I mean, it's not just at random. It's, I think, it's strategically based, and they're guiding that. But they come on in and they say, okay, this area where the buffalo used to roam now has to have the same amount for buffalo, and by the way, it has to be, you know, sufficient natural habitat for them, which basically means the reversion of that area. And oh, by the way, some buffalo are over here too. We have to have a corridor. In other words, you know, some X mile, 100 mile wide or whatever, 50 mile wide chunk designated as wilderness as well, so that the buffalo can go from one pocket to the next pocket. And oh, by the way, we need to have a buffer zone around that, and we need to have a buffer zone around the buffer zone. And pretty much when you start to connect these areas and you start looking at these corridors, what it really means is that a growing, it's like these balloons, the people are standing here and somebody is throwing in some deflated balloons and now they're blowing them up. And pretty soon the balloons fill up the room and people all squashed in the interspace between the balloons. It's basically a huge land grab and a movement to put reduced population and put people into the equivalent of communes, which is the basis of the word communism. I mean, that's the philosophy of communism, is communes. And at the same time, it's not just it's just not moving people into communes, like you say. You're eliminating, you're reducing the amount of water, you're reducing the amount of energy, you're reducing the amount of food, you're reducing the amount of this. It's going to affect the entire nation, I think, don't you?
Oh, I think it does. I think that one of the things that people need to realize is that whether you're living in Los Angeles or San Francisco, somebody grew the food that's on the grocery store shelf. Somebody mined the copper in your wires. Those all came from rural America. And so we need to have a much greater realization about the connection between rural America and urban America, because there's absolutely no question that urban America needs us. And we do not want to be importing our food and our fiber from foreign nations. We see what happens when we import foreign oil, and that just simply drives up gas prices, and you're going to see the same thing with food, and that's even harder to deal with specifically because, you know, gas prices, you don't have to worry as much about food safety, but you certainly do when you're dealing with what you're feeding your children.
I think it not only drives up prices, but it increases, you know, the trade deficit, which increases the debts, and we become more, as a nation, more and more indebted, more and more. They used to say, well, it doesn't matter because we owe it to ourselves. Well, that was a lie at the beginning, but, you know, that lie has been exposed, and now they're kind of quiet on that issue. But the reality is we learn, you know, China, here communist nations are buying our debt. Well, that means we're their servants. You know, I kind of figured it out at one point in time that roughly 100 million Americans, their tax incomes were going to payments of the debt on the national debts owned by Chinese, communist Chinese. In other words, 100 million Americans were working for the communist Chinese through this whole system. And it's not just a matter of, you know, increasing prices and also indebtedness, but when you become the debtor, you become the slave, the servant, and eventually forget sovereignty and your ability to defend yourself and security. I mean, those things eventually all go out the window. You know, here we are, the nation that used to be the biggest producer. I mean, we invented everything that has to do with the modern age. If we didn't, you know, Western civilization certainly did. Computers, electricity, electric motors, cars, airplanes, you know, internet, you name it, TVs, LCDs. I mean, we invented it all. And here we are, we've exported industry after industry, starting with the labor-intensive ones like, you know, clothing manufacturing, those kind of things. And then it just kept moving up the thing, and they started exporting, you know, higher-level jobs, and pretty soon they were exporting product engineering and exporting technology manufacture. Next thing you know, we're exporting the engineering, the product engineering part of that. Next thing we know, we're exporting the design engineering part of that thing, and next thing you know, we're exporting this. We've exported our manufacturing industries, we've exported our technologies, and here we were, the breadbasket of the world, and perhaps the one remaining thing that we have that we is kind of a large industry that we actually produce is, in fact, rural America, and it seems to me that that's all being threatened by this process, and that will affect us all.
Well, I would certainly agree with your analysis. I mean, not... Even if you agree with all of the argument that you know, the environment is more important than people, the sad thing is that without people living in these rural environments, the environment won't be as good. There are numerous testimonies and scientific articles about how wildlife depend on what humans do on their grazing allotments and on their private lands in terms of producing better forage, in terms of protecting water sources. What happens in a drought is that ranchers haul water and take water to their livestock, which is also used by wildlife. So the idea that even species will be much better off if we eliminate rural America and we eliminate livestock grazing is completely ludicrous and not supported by the scientific industry. That's why I honestly believe that this is not about species and it's not about the environment. It's about control of people.
So the Equal Access to Justice Act is really a source of money term being used against us. So what are your ideas about how to solve that problem?
I think the first thing that we have to do is get accountability back into the act. I think that the American public has a right to know where its tax dollars are being paid. And I find it interesting that environmental groups just complain and complain that they're not making near as much money as we have charged, but they are not willing to support accountability and transparency. And I think that if they thought that I was going to be proven wrong in my charges regarding $36 million in payouts over 9 years, I think that they would welcome transparency. So I think that's the first thing that has to happen, and there are some congressional bills that have been introduced both in the Senate and in the House for that transparency. There's also a House bill that is actually looking at substantive reform of the Equal Access to Justice Act, and the name of that bill is the Government Litigation Savings Act, introduced by Congresswoman Cynthia Lummis from Wyoming. that bill actually goes farther, and it puts a hard cap on attorney's fees so that environmental groups can't get $650 an hour. It equalizes the treatment of nonprofit and for-profit. So that whether if you're a nonprofit and your net worth is over $7 million, you can't qualify either, just like a for-profit organization or a business could not qualify. So it equalizes that playing field. It limits the amount of times that you can get money from the federal government when you do these lawsuits over and over and over. Center for Biological Diversity has filed hundreds of lawsuits in a single year. And this bill would eliminate the number of times that that group could be paid simply because they're filing the same hundreds and hundreds of lawsuits over and over and over again. That bill has gone through the Judiciary Committee, and we are hoping to get it to the floor of the House sometime in March of 2012.
What can people do to help?
Absolutely contact your congressmen and your senators and get them to seriously look at this legislation and to support this legislation. This legislation is absolutely good for America. I believe that the numbers will show that American tax dollars are being wasted or being scammed through this litigation. And right now, at a time when people are losing their homes and losing their businesses and don't know whether they're going to have jobs, America needs to stop paying out millions of dollars in attorney's fees. And so I would encourage people to get with their congressmen and senators and really look at settling this litigation.
Do you have the bill numbers?
And forcing getting the bill passed. Yes, I do have the bill numbers. The House bill is, I have to look, I need a second here. The House bill is H.R. 1996. And the companion Senate
Go ahead.
And the companion Senate bill is 1061.
So H.R. 1996 and S.B. 1061. Is that this judiciary, I mean, the government accountability one?
Yes. Governmental Litigation Savings Act is the name of the bill.
Okay. And Representative Loomis?
Yes.
Now, is there, if people want to connect and help and actually kind of network on this or go to some central source, is there some central source where people can join in, kind of a hub that's leading an effort to get this thing passed?
I don't know whether I would call it a central effort. There's groups called the Western Legacy Alliance that have put a lot of effort into supporting this legislation, and their website contains information. I know that your website, Defend Rural America, has got lots of information on these bills and are, you know, willing to put information out there. I'd say those are the best sources that I know of for information.
Do you happen to know the Western Legacy Alliance? Is that also their website address?
Yes.
Okay. Now, before we go on to another topic, is there anything else you'd like to say about the Equal Access to Justice Act?
I believe I've said it before, but I don't think that I can emphasize it enough, that I believe that these groups are truly as capitalistic as I am, but these environmental groups simply don't admit it. I believe that these groups are in this to make money, that it's not about the environment, it's not about species protection. They can dress up their actions as much as they want, but when you dig through all of that stuff and get to the bottom line, it's about control and it's about money. And I believe that if we can shut off some of this money, that you're going to see these groups lessen their grip of power on the litigation system and on the bureaucracy as well as on the Congress.
Okay, Kay, you had a question?
Yes, Karen, this is Dr. Kate. Thank you very much for your discussion, and it's just terrific that you're here. It sounds to me like when the federal government encourages these environmental organizations to sue and then the federal government settles and then pays everybody, that this borders on a RICO, borders on racketeering. And I'm wondering if there's, beyond the legislation, if there is anyone looking at the racket that the environmental organizations and federal government are involved in. And just as an aside, I really believe you're right about population control and resource control. That was just a question I had.
I got to tell you, when we started on this, we looked at every legal way possible to do a lawsuit to be able to stop this rather than going the legislation route, just simply because I was concerned with writing a bill and then turning it loose in Congress. You never know exactly what you're going to get out the other end. The problem with bringing either a RICO suit or any other kind of suit is you would have to have the Justice Department agreeing that the money was being funneled out in a wrong manner. Remember years and years ago when they had that big scandal that the military was paying huge amounts of money for toilet seats and wrenches and all that kind of stuff? We looked at doing that with these kind of fees, saying that, you know, this is intentional shifting of money from the American tax base to these environmental groups. But we were not able to find an actual cause of action. The other hard part about RICO is you actually have to name individuals. You can't say, you know, the entire Justice Department. And tracing down the individuals who are making these decisions has proved to be nearly impossible.
Okay. You know, in kind of a, I'm going to add my own agreement to both of you. I believe that the new color of communism is green. Once you peel it back and look at the people behind it, it's just communism that's getting given an environmental facework, but the wolf beneath the lamb's wool is communism. The next topic perhaps we could talk about would be coordination. Would you like to go ahead and start off talking about that?
Certainly. One of the ways that I believe that we can take America back is by really looking at the power and authority that locally elected officials, whether they be local sheriffs or county commissions or local school boards, whatever locally elected body you have, and look and see what they can do in dealing with the federal government. One of the things that I guess I didn't realize and really surprised me when I was working at the Reagan administration was how little understanding Washington has of anything west of Washington. For example, when I went back to Washington, one of the first things I worked on was grazing fees and regulations dealing with Bureau of Land Management land. My father has Bureau of Land Management permits. We've had those connected with that ranch for generations. But interestingly enough, the guy in Washington that was in charge of actually writing those regulations and reviewing those fees was from Cleveland. And he'd gone to Washington. He'd gone to a very prestigious law school in Washington, D.C. He graduated with honors. He was absolutely one of the smartest people I ever met. And he'd never been west of Cleveland. And so when I talked about space and Wyoming and our ranch, when I told him the size, he thought that was all the land in Wyoming because he didn't have anything that he understood to be close to what a cattle ranch was and what we did. When you talked about water, he just thought it rained all the time. He didn't have any understanding that rural areas live and die by water rights and by who controls the water and how important it is to be able to have water to water your crops and to water your animals. Yet this was the guy that was going to dictate how my father grazed on his allotments in Big Piney, Wyoming. And so from that, I really started looking at how do we get the rural people more involved. I mean, I understand the argument that these are public lands and that these are public areas and that the public ought to have a say. And I don't disagree with that. But I do believe that decisions are better informed when locally elected officials actually have a seat at the table and can supply the information, particularly on local issues such as the local citizens, the local tax environment, the local economics, and the local environment, because we're the people that live here. We're the people that understand how federal decisions are going to impact us. And so working through coordination process, working through things like the National Environmental Policy Act and the Federal Land Policy and Management Act and some of these acts, we're working with local governments so that they understand what they need to do to really have an impact on federal decisions that are going to affect their local community or their local forest or their local public land or whatever the case may be.
So go ahead and give us some more detail then on coordination and the you know, it's a word we're used to in English, but it has some legal significance. So why don't you go ahead and explain that?
Coordination is actually used as part of the Federal Land Policy and Management Act to require that local governments be directly involved in making federal decisions. Not just receive a copy of the decision and offer comments and the federal government can take or ignore your comments as they want, but actually be involved in the decision-making process. And so it's actually a legal term as well as a term that people use every day. What it requires is for the local government, though, to take action. The local government wants to be involved in the decision. The local government needs to understand why. I don't think that it is possible for the local government just to go to a federal agency and say, okay, you have to coordinate with me and do nothing further than that. Rather, if you look at the Federal Land Policy and Management Act, it talks about if the local government has got some sort of a policy or a plan or a program, that the federal government has to absolutely consider that it has to comply with the local land use plan or the local policy, assuming the local policy complies with federal law, that it has to try to mitigate for action, and that if it's going to reject the local policy or plan, it has to tell the local government and the public why in writing, and that the reasons it is not following local plan have got to be valid reasons. And they've got to be made on the record. If you look at the National Environmental Policy Act, which applies to every single federal decision that is ever made, whether it's a land decision or a transportation or roads or anything else, the National Environmental Policy Act talks about how the federal government must consider locally adopted land use plans. And again, they have to consider those. They don't have to consider local plans that violate federal law, but if you've got plans that comply with federal law that recognize local needs, the local citizens, the local custom and culture, the local economic base, the federal government has to consider those and has to take those into account in its decision-making processes. So while it may be a lot of work for a local government, it is a way to make the local voice heard. And if the federal government doesn't have a good reason for rejecting a local plan, you then have the option of proceeding to federal court.
Now, the requirement is, if I understand correctly, is that the federal government has to respond, listen to and respond to the local community's concerns, the local government's concerns, but only if the local government requests it. There's no requirement of the federal government to proactively invite that participation or even tell local governments they even have that right. They can pretty much ignore it and be quiet about it, correct?
No, actually the federal government is supposed to notify the local government of any action it's going to take that may affect the local community. It is then up to the local community or the local county or the local sheriff to determine if they want to participate through this higher level of participation through coordination. And so it's not a requirement that the local community participate in every single federal agency decision within the county, because quite honestly, there are some decisions that simply don't matter to the local government. But they should get a notice of every decision, and then it's up to the local government to determine how it wants to participate and when, and then insert itself into the process in the proper way.
Now, there's various local government agents and people. Who specifically would these notices go to?
They're supposed to go to locally elected officials. And so we're talking about county commissioners or locally elected sheriffs or locally elected school boards or rural communities, whatever governing locally elected body you would have.
Now there could be a lot of those. Are they required to notify every elected official, or do they decide which relevant officials or groups, local government entities, are ones that are appropriate to notify, and then just notify one person? Or, I mean, what are the notification requirements? I guess is what I'm asking, because I suspect that a lot of people, the public, doesn't know about coordination and legal rights here, and I'm beginning to wonder if it's their representatives don't know or don't get the notifications, or they get the notifications and ignoring them.
Most of the time, what I've seen is they notify the county clerk, who then passes to pass it on to the county commissioners, or they notify the sheriff's office, and then hopefully somebody in that office will look at the notification, read it, and understand it. A lot of federal agencies keep lists, and so they send out monthly or quarterly or, whatever the time period is, update on every single federal decision that they do. There's a lot of requirements about notification in local publications, so the local newspaper a lot of time will carry those, but these are going to be legal notices in the back that maybe people read and maybe they don't read. And so I think if they notified the clerk, I think that's good enough. I don't think the court is going to fault them for not notifying every single elected county official. The requirement is to notify the locally elected bodies, and if you do that by the county clerk and then publish something in the local newspaper, and then obviously you publish something in the Federal Register, I think that's all that's legally required.
I think
what I found is that it's not the notification that's lacking, it's the understanding by local governments about what to do is where I think the breakdown is, because for a long time, the federal agencies worked with the rural community. It hasn't been until, say, the last 10 years or so that we've started to see this huge shift away from considering the needs of the rural community and away from local participation in these decisions.
The notification requirements that I know of, I'm not an expert in this, but the legal notices here in the Bay Area, for example, I believe go into special kinds. They only have to publish them in one newspaper, not all, and there's certain special type of newspapers. It's not like your San Jose Mercury News that these notifications go into. It's these obscure publications that somehow meet the legal requirement, but they're generally not available to the public. The public doesn't necessarily read them. Is that case in counties and so forth?
Yes, I believe that is true. But the way to solve that is for either members of the general public or the locally elected body to write a letter to the whatever federal agency you're dealing with and say, I want notification sent directly to me, and then they're going to be required to do that.
Okay. Now, in the coordination, who can actually make a demand of the federal government to coordinate?
Again, it's locally elected officials. Now, a lot of times what happens, especially in rural communities, because it's so difficult for the local county commission to deal with federal government problems and local road issues and local tax issues, and locally elected officials pulled so many different ways. I've seen a lot of local governments appoint advisory committees or citizens committees to deal with certain issues like federal land issues or like travel issues or like access issues. And then these advisory committees can then, you know, go through the process and report to the county commission so that not every county commissioner has to participate in every single meeting just simply because it's not possible for the county commissioners to do. But in the legal sense, who is participating is locally elected officials, a locally elected body, or the locally elected sheriff.
Now, it's interesting, I think, in our conversation, as I was thinking about it relative to Siskiyou County and being, you know, somewhat knowledgeable about some of the things they're looking at, when you talk about locally elected officials and entities, you know, you really have a diversity, and say the dam removal that's going on up there, it's not just one governmental agency is going to be impacted. You have, obviously, the county, so the county commissioners come into play. The sheriff's concerned about, you know, what's going to happen with public access and public safety and so forth. You have fire districts are saying, hey, you know, you take out the dams, you've taken out the reservoir. Gosh, that's the water we use to fight forest fires and to save our homes. In other words, it seems to me that there are a lot of different local agencies that have a stake in the game, and that the strategy for people in their local communities that want to take advantage of coordination should identify and pursue each and every one of those.
I would certainly agree with that. I think that different locally elected boards have different areas of expertise. And what we're really trying to do with this is get local expertise into these federal agency decisions. And so if you've got a locally elected body that specifically deals with the economic tax base, then that expertise needs to be tapped. And if you've got the local sheriff whose big concern is keeping access open for search and rescue or for public safety, that expertise ought to be tapped. So I don't see this as just the county commissioners get to carry the whole ball. In fact, I would dissuade that kind of thinking and agree that everyone with an expertise be involved.
And for people who like to learn more about coordination, I know that I have some information on the Defend Rural America website, actually information courtesy of Karen and Conversations. It's on the legal page. There's a link to coordination. There's more information on stuff like that and also the Equal Access to Justice Act. Where else should people go to learn more? Because I think that the thing is that for Tea Party members or other grassroots members who want to make a difference, they can get educated on this and then take the information to their locally elected officials and educate them and make sure that they follow up. So where would they go next?
There are several groups that are working on these issues. You've got conservation groups that are working on these issues, such as natural resource conservation districts and that kind of thing. Those usually have quite a bit of information. There's a group in Texas, Stewards of Liberty, or that may not be the right name, but they've got quite a bit of information. I've got legal publications on my website for Bud Fallon law offices that have got information. And so I think there is quite a bit of information out there, but getting it into the hand of local officials is, I think, what the key is here.
Gotcha. How would people contact you?
The easiest way is to contact me through our website, and the website is www. And then it's my last name with no hyphen. B as in boy, U D D, F as in Frank, A L E N. .com.
Okay, and you want to go ahead and repeat that one more time?
Sure. www.budfallon.com. And it's B as in boy, U-D-D, F as in Frank, A-L-E-N.com. And I don't think uppercase or lowercase or any of that stuff matters.
Karen, I want to thank you so much. We're about to roll into the second segment here in the show, but you are just remarkable. I know I personally have learned so much from my conversations with you. I certainly hope that the listeners have learned. I think that they're going to greatly appreciate tonight's show. I have a suspicion it's going to be heard and reheard by a lot of folks. I want to thank you very much for your time.
I am very happy to do it, and I am very glad to have more help spreading the word that if we want to take America back, we have to do it now, and we have to act affirmatively, and these are good ways to do it.
Karen, thank you again.
Karen, I want to thank you also for being on with us tonight. I've been a little quiet because you guys have been making it flow pretty well, so I didn't want to interrupt that. But I also want to invite you to stick around for a while. I know that you and Kurt both have another appointment later tonight, but right now I'm about to introduce our next guest, Timothy Baldwin, and I really hope that you hang in here with us for a while. And after Tim's had a chance to give some opening comments, you're certainly welcome to get back in and ask the questions, because he's right up in Montana, not too far from you in Wyoming, and you guys certainly are on the same team, and I think it would really be good for you to be able to ask questions or get to know each other a little bit. So hang in there, Karen.
I will be happy to do that. Thank you.
I want to introduce our next guest. Attorney Timothy Baldwin is a published author, public speaker, and definitely an extraordinary political philosopher. And Tim, I just want to tell you, I really enjoyed reading your articles, and we've got a lot to talk about. The other guy's been quiet for the last hour. It's on with us as a co-host tonight is Red Beckman. And Red, you want to say hello to Tim Baldwin?
I would love to. I sure am glad to welcome him to the show, because he has a voice and it is being heard, and that's that makes him a special person in my book, because he is being heard, and we got a lot of people out here that are saying things, but they're not reaching the numbers that we need to reach, and so I'm more than happy to have Tim on the show, and I'm going to be real quiet and give him all the time that we have available.
Tim, welcome to Walls in Our Minds.
Thank you very much, everybody, for having me on the show. It's a pleasure to be with you tonight.
Well, we've got, I mean, a myriad of things that we could talk about. I mean, we could spend an hour just on Romans 13. You know, your article on that was tremendous, and that's something that's close to Red's heart as well, and mine too. But I don't want to start you out in one direction or another. I don't want to dictate that to you. I know that, you know, you've got a lot of things you could talk about in the next hour, and I want you to start out where you want to start out. What's closest and nearest and dearest to your heart, and maybe give the folks here that may not be familiar with you a little background on yourself, and then you take it where you want to go, Tim.
Okay. Well, I am 32 years old. I have my lovely wife, Jennifer, who I've been married to for 4 years, and we have two small children under the age of 18 months, both of them, so we're a busy and growing family. I have lived in Montana for the past year and a half, but I grew up in Florida under my dad, who is Chuck Baldwin, and I grew up in Pensacola, Florida, and then I went to law school at the age of 21 to Samford University in Birmingham, Alabama, and I received my Juris Doctorate degree from there. And after that, I became a criminal prosecutor for the state of Florida. I went back to Florida and practiced for that first step in my career. And I spent 2.5 years at that office, and I got a tremendous amount of trial experience and litigation experience. And then from there, I started my own practice in 2006 at the age of 26. And I basically handled a general practice, and it kind of changed into a specialty of property management representation. I did that until I moved from Florida to Montana back in 2010. And since I've been in Montana, I've been handling a variety of cases, as well as been involved politically here quite a bit. And in the meantime, through all of that process, I began to, I guess, start my own search and my own quest for understanding liberty, understanding freedom, and how that relates to our society and our constitutional form of government. So back in 2008, I endeavored to study not just what our founding fathers believed, but study those sources that they studied to understand what was in their mind at the time of our founding. So I really entrenched myself and saturated my time of study into Enlightenment philosophy and fell in love with the philosophy of political thought and have been really studying it ardently ever since. And from that experience, it has really launched my desire to write and expound upon political philosophy and how can we get to these core issues that decide the roads we are going to take as a society and as the government we choose. And I've been doing that extensively for the past 4 years. And I do it mainly through my website, which is libertydefenseleague.com. And it's been quite an experience for me, and I've met a lot of great people, have been in contact with a lot of outstanding individuals, and I'm meeting more people as I go, such as yourselves. And it's been good to do this. We're not alone, and this is something we all need to take a serious interest in. So that's my introduction. I'll go from wherever you guys want to go. It's up to you guys, really.
Well, let me steer you a little bit then, because what Karen and them have been talking about, and Kurt, you might even want to contribute to this. Karen, you might too, but they've been talking about to generalize about federal intervention into things like the Endangered Species Act and taking out the dams of the Klamath River and the things that are going on with the Siskiyou County situation and a lot of the constitutional sheriffs and the battles that are going on and the struggles of trying to figure out how to best approach attacking some of these things. We've talked about grand juries in the past. I know you were a prosecuting attorney for some time and did a lot of jury trials. One of the things that fascinated me was your article on Attorney General Jim Shockley and his shocking view of the Constitution. Of course, he is considers himself to be a conservative attorney general in the state of Montana, and yet they looked to solve things in a way of allowing the federal government to be the solution, and they're the ones creating the problem or going to the court, for example. I appreciated the fact that you said going to the federal courts is not the solution. You know, we've already got a Constitution. Why don't we hold to that? Maybe that's a place to start out.
Yeah, and just to clarify, the article I wrote about Jim Shockley, he's actually a candidate for Attorney General for Montana, and that election is going right now, and the primary is in June of this year. So as of now, he's the only Republican candidate for Attorney General, and it looks as though if there's nobody else more notable than he who runs against him, either on the Republican ticket or the Democrat ticket, then he probably will win this election. And the article that you referenced, which is at libertydefenseleague.com, if your listeners want to go to that website and find that article, it's entitled "Candidate for Montana Attorney General Jim Shockley Holds Shocking View of the Constitution." And I start with Jim Shockley's synopsis of his view of the Constitution, which is a skewed version of the Constitution based upon the Civil War. And his view is that the Civil War essentially made federal laws supreme over state laws, regardless of their constitutionality. And he proposes that the only way we can check the federal government easily is either through the federal courts or through a constitutional amendment. And I took him to task on that, both historically and constitutionally. And since then, he responded to my article and asked me to publish it, which I did. And that's actually the latest article I have published on libertydefenseleague.com. And so, but what you've described is really a, and Kate would probably agree with this, most attorneys have this fallacious idea that the federal laws will trump state laws no matter what, and that the states really have no authority to question or to interpose themselves between the citizens and the federal government, and that this supremacy clause means that the only way we can defend ourselves is through the court or through the amendment process. And that's, if you read the Federalist Papers alone, you will see that that was not the understanding of the ratification of the Constitution. And so we have an entire several generations of attorneys and judges and those in the legal field who are spreading this, what I would say is a false doctrine of the Constitution. And it's really no wonder why we're seeing the federal government do what it's doing and has been doing for many, many years in complete disregard to the constitutional checks and balances we have in place in our Constitution.
Well, this is something that Red and I have talked about a lot, and it really comes back down to the people being the true sovereigns and really having the right to judge the law. And when bad law comes into play, the people should be able to nullify that. I mean, I believe you also know a buddy of mine by the name of Martin Babbitts, who wrote The Illusion of Freedom, and I don't know if you're familiar with Tom Woods, I'm sure you are, but that wrote Nullification. And essentially, that's the same position you're taking, is it not?
Well, I would say it's really not even just nullification. I would say it's interposition. Nullification has this sort of an implied notion of passivity. That is, the state cannot take active steps to prevent, let's just say, federal agents or federal bureaucracy agents from coming in and shutting down a business that's operating under state laws because they supposedly are violating some sort of environmental law or some sort of Endangered Species Act or anything along those lines. When you read the Federalist Papers and you look at how Hamilton and Madison really laid out this idea of the states actually standing and opposing the federal government, they meant using the forces of government that the states have at their disposal, meaning whether it's state police or county, the county sheriffs and their deputies, whether it's a state militia, which was the purpose of the Second Amendment. They explicitly refer to these things as a method of interposition, and that ultimately the decision of who is right and who is wrong comes down to the people, and as they say, throwing their weight into the balance to determine who is going to be who's going to succeed in determining which government is correct in their use of force of law. So that's something we haven't seen in a very long time, because of course the Civil War has skewed our thinking as to what is constitutional government, what is constitutional checks and balances, including between the state and federal government.
Red, do you want to say anything to Tim regarding this?
I have no confidence whatever in the federal court system. It is, in my experience, they have proven to be a criminal syndicate, and I base that on several different situations. And of course, the most visible of these situations is our effort to challenge the authenticity, the ratification procedure on the 16th Amendment and the 17th Amendment to the Constitution. because we have the evidence of fraud on both of those very important amendments, especially the 17th. I've said for a long time that the 16th has been very expensive for the American people, but the 17th was a major problem that has helped give us the kind of government that we have today. And so we have, you know, these thousands upon thousands. There's over 17,000 certified documents. We spent a lot of money. We accumulated all of these documents, and it is very obvious that the 16th Amendment, the income tax amendment, was a fraud perpetrated by politicians. Well, I'd say there were criminals more so than politicians. Some politicians, of course, might be honest and such, but this was a clear-cut case of fraud, and the 17th is no different. We have all these documentation, all this documentation, all certified, all proving that the 16th and 17th Amendments are both fraud. Now, we complied with the law. The law, Title 18, the U.S. Criminal Code, Section 4, says that if you know of a crime, if you know of a crime, well, I'll just read it. Whoever having knowledge of the actual commission of a felony cognizable by a court of the United States conceals and does not, as soon as possible, make known the same to some judge or other person in civil or military authority under the United States, shall be fined not more than $500 or imprisoned not more than 3 years or both. That's just one of half a dozen different statutes that have been violated by the federal courts and the justice system as a whole in Washington, D.C. We complied with that law. We did what we were quite convinced going into this that there was some fraud involved in the ratification process, and so we identified it, we researched it, we spent a lot of money, and we noticed the judges, the federal judges, we noticed the military, we noticed everybody of what we had. And the book, The Law That Never Was, Volume 1, came out in April of 1985. And we have been denied, just literally denied justice since 1985. Now, we're talking about, you know, what is it, 35 years or 25 years? 27 years we've been denied justice. We've been denied, and these are very expensive. These are very critical amendments to the Constitution. Probably the two of the most critical of all, other than the 14th, and so
it wasn't properly ratified either.
Right. Well, we have that evidence too. So, you know, it's I have no confidence, and I've known some of these people. I sued a federal judge, and when I sued him, it went to the U.S. Supreme Court and was docketed, and the Solicitor General noticed the parties to the action that I was correct and that he was not going to defend the criminals in government, but the Supreme Court has never heard it. As near as we know, it's still docketed after all these years, because it was docketed in 1996. So you can see where justice has been denied, even a hearing of any kind. And we tried to get to federal grand jury in different places, and we were had the door slammed in our face, you might say. So there is not going to be any justice in the courts, I don't believe. Sure, we have some isolated cases, but we have a tendency to forget that a federal judge, and I don't care whether he's just a district court judge that's just been appointed as a judge or whether it is the nine justices on the U.S. Supreme Court, they are all government agents. They are employees of the government. They draw a paycheck, the tax money that people pay in is used to pay their salaries, and they are government agents. That's the only way we can explain them, you know, at this point in time. And so they have a conflict of interest, and nobody wants to cite them for this. Nobody wants to, you know, when we have a conflict, a controversy between the citizen and government, how in the world can you have justice if you've got a judge sitting on the bench that, you know, is going to make decisions, and here he is, he's got a conflict of interest because he is an agent of the government that is causing the problem. So I'm just glad that Tim is here. He's you know, I've said it many times, 35 years ago when I started speaking out, I was really lonesome. I'm not lonesome anymore because and especially I want to pat him on the back because he's a young person. And we need these generations that are just coming up now. We've got to get to them, and we've got to get the truth to them and help them to understand how that my generation and the one that followed me, I think we have done it to ourselves. We didn't tend the store like we should have. So, Tim, all I can say is go after him, and we're glad you're on our side.
Tim, well, I want to let you have the follow-up to Red's comments, Tim, but I also want to let Karen know who's going to have to leave in about 10 or 15 minutes. I want to make sure she is able to get in a question to you on this topic before we shift gears. So, Tim, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I just want to say I appreciate his comments. This is certainly an effort that is a daunting task, but at the same time, we know that the momentum is in our favor, and people are beginning to wake up more and more as to what is constitutional government, what is liberty. People are waking up and studying for themselves and not just accepting what they hear on maybe, say, Fox News. So it's a good thing, and we just have to continue doing what we're doing. And I'm willing to answer any questions anybody may have.
Karen, do you have a question at this point or like to make a comment to what they said?
I think that my comment would be in total agreement with Red when he talks about how we have really failed because we have failed to teach the next generation about what the Constitution is and what it means. And how important it is to understand that document and how important it is to take your citizenship in this country absolutely seriously. I do a lot of work with high school groups and college groups in terms of teaching agriculture law, and it always just really disappoints me when I talk to the kids about voting and are they going to vote and do they understand what that means, and so many of the kids today say they don't know and they don't care. And I think it's really because, you know, this generation was working so hard to make life better for the next generation that we also forgot to teach them about the trials and tribulations and difficulties the founders had in putting together this government. And if we don't understand this government, it is doomed to fail. If we don't understand the Constitution, it is doomed to fail. And so I applaud people who are working on this. I am thrilled to see that people who are much younger than I am are taking this to heart, and I encourage us all to work with high school kids and college kids and young people to really teach them what this Constitution does and mean and says, because our country depends on it.
And she's exactly right. And it's, you know, I was actually today, it's funny that you mentioned the high schoolers, because today I was invited to a private high school here in Kalispell, Montana, to help the students in their in a competition they're engaged in, which is a competition of understanding and articulating the Constitution and different issues of society that involved using the Constitution. And so I spent about an hour and a half today in that class judging six teams on various questions they had to answer. And, you know, it was good to see that they had an interest in knowing the Constitution, and it was good to see that the school placed an emphasis on learning the Constitution, because without the young people coming up, who are, it seems anymore, they're just, you know, they're saturated with things even I wasn't exposed to as a younger person, and we're becoming more and more of a socialist type country, a socialist constitution. And so if they don't understand on their own, and they don't have a desire to learn what it meant in 1787 and 1776, then the future of this country and the future of our children and grandchildren looks very grim. And so we have to have these young people get involved, but that takes people like us to get out there and show them that this stuff really matters. And it actually is very interesting. It's based on sociological studies, psychology, human nature, all these things that are sciences of people that that determine the outcomes of all these things, and it's quite fascinating. So, yeah, absolutely. It's our job to get involved, and we better do it soon, or else I think we're going to miss opportunities that we may never have again.
Well, Karen, I want to thank you for hanging in here with us, and you're welcome to stick around. And if you've got any more comments and time to inject, please feel free. Tim, we've got about 28 minutes left to go in the show, and I'm not going to let you get out of here without talking about Ron Paul. But frankly, I think we need to do a whole show on just focusing on the spiritual battle that we're facing here, because I think that's really – That's what's at the foundational crux of all of our problems. And I don't even want to try to go there now, because I don't think we've got time. So I'd love to ask you back to spend a full 2 hours just talking about the spiritual battle. But I know that everybody's interested, all of our listeners. You're in amongst like-minded people, and you had this debate going back and forth with J.B. Williams. You want to tell us about that?
Well, yeah, it's one of the articles I recently posted in response to J.B. Williams' article, essentially bashing Ron Paul. It really wasn't even a, hey, let's vote for Romney, or hey, let's vote for Gingrich or Santorum. It was a, hey, let's just not vote for Ron Paul. Everybody else will do fine. It was, you know, a lot of people were taken by surprise with his article because of just how off the wall it was. And so I just had to take the opportunity to respond to that. And apparently, a lot of people were upset with J.B. Williams' article, because I received so many positive responses when I posted my article, probably one of the most responded to articles I've ever written. And they were all saying the same thing. You know, more and more we're seeing people who appear to be, well, we use the word conservative, but appear to love the Constitution, appear to love the liberties protected by the Constitution, who are becoming enemies to people like Ron Paul, who are the most constitutionalist of any of the candidates. So it's a very interesting dynamic what's going on in these so-called conservative groups to see this sort of division between people like maybe Romney or Gingrich and others like Ron Paul.
Well, I thought you were kind, Mr. Williams. JB's been on our show before, and you know Tim Harrington has too, and we've had others associated with that group. You know, their veterans group and people that we've had on here. And I remembered an article that JB Williams wrote before he stopped writing for Canada Free Press, where he talked about the enemies within, and one of those enemies was basically rhinos, if you will, that, Kate, we'll get you in here in a half a second, about basically the rhinos that throw up the donate button. And subsequent to that time, it seems like that organization's been doing a lot of that. And,
yeah.
And I think that their attacks on Dr. Paul have been congruent or consistent with the bankster establishment that really backs both parties, that kind of facilitates the left-right debate, both serving their own purposes, their own hidden agendas, you know, to increase debt, et cetera. And it seems like, you know, they've been a facilitator for that. And it kind of burns me to see them taking these fraudulent, and I'm sorry, I didn't mean to use that term, these somewhat propaganda mantra type things and throw them out there at somebody just to see if it sticks. Or in some cases, they don't know any better because they really don't understand what the real policies of a man like Dr. Paul are that has the experience that he has. They also don't take into consideration, Tim, what Dr. Paul doesn't say because he can't say it. I mean, if he starts going off into what some people classify as conspiracy theories that we all know are true conspiracies, but they're not theory, they're really fact. If he starts coming out and defending his position in that way, he's going to get even more marginalized than he already is. So I perceive him as doing the best he can under the circumstances, and these guys don't see that. They can't see the forest for the trees, and they just throw these things out purely without merit. You know, without merit. It's without merit, but there's another word that I use when capricious. These charges are capricious. Are they not?
Well, that was the basis of my response when I wrote this article, was that, you know, J.B. Williams had all these horrible things to say, but he didn't have one piece of evidence or fact or even a reference to support what he was saying. Not only that, but he showed to everybody the shallowness of his thinking. He used words like conservative and liberal, and he used words, these little tag labels, to try to get people to just pit people in a group. And if you're not a part of this group, you're not good, without any references, even to the Constitution itself. So, you know, if this is what people are thinking, and this is the thought process people have in this country when they're looking at voting for any office, and of course the President of the United States is one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful, and yet, you know, there's no substance there, and so it's a very sad statement to be made when a guy like J.B. Williams, who supposedly you know, has a good reputation for being a conservative or whatever word you want to use, freedom oriented, to use this kind of debased and simplified and almost childish sort of analysis regarding the most one of the most crucial elections of our country. So he had to be called to task on it, and I was, you know, willing to do it. And apparently, given the responses I had, a lot of other people were saying the exact same thing, and they were upset with him, and really they should have been.
Dr. Kate, you invited Tim to the show and you've republished his article on your blog today. Please jump in here and say hello.
Tim, it's a pleasure to talk with you, and I thank you so much for joining us this evening.
It's my pleasure seeing you.
And, you know, I've watched J.B. Williams for a long time, but it's like it's reached a crescendo where you have so-called conservatives and so-called constitutional conservatives calling Ron Paul a nut and really misstating the Constitution. And, Red, I had Red, nice to talk with you as well. I often repeat the statements on statesmen versus politicians in my blog to sort of remind people that that is the framework in which we need to choose candidates. And I'd just like to read this for our audience, but it was one of the most profound statements, Tim, and I wanted to thank you for it. America would be in better shape if we had more statesmen discussing the issues in light of constitutional argument and not through political labels used to dumb down the thought process of choosing a candidate. My question really is, what is it, fear? Is it miseducation? You know, you talk about J.B. Williams and the Patriots Union. I'm sure he has a multi-million dollar budget right now, calling people to join him at military, so forth and so on. And while I applaud that effort, when he comes out with this kind of stuff, it really is disheartening. So what is going on here? Is it just absolute fear? Even those who should be completely astute to this and working on it are just blinded by this ridiculous false paradigm that takes us all away from the Constitution. I still remember, I'm in my mid-50s, and I still remember the constitutional education I got, which a lot of people are not getting right now. And so I guess it's more of a hello and thank you for your work, and I look forward to talking with you some more. But what do you see is going on here? Is it fear? And wherefore and where should we go? And how should we proceed? I don't know if you know anything about my background, but, you know, I happen to be stuck being a hydrologist and writing a constitutional blog. And these rural land issues are extremely important to me. You know, where do we go now? And that probably was just a lousy question that you could, I'm sure, answer in about 10 hours, but there you go. My point hello and thank you for being here.
Thank you, Dr. Kate. It's a question that if we could answer it, I think we could probably wouldn't be in a lot of the problems we're in. I can only tell you how my thought process has grown over the past many years. I went through the education that attorneys go through, and that wasn't what equipped me to think critically and to start thinking in terms of statesmanship as opposed to political labels, which, as the phrase you quoted me on, which is dumbing down the thought process of Americans. You know, I think it comes down to what you expose your mind to. If all you're doing is listening to national talking heads on TV or listening to them on the radio, you are not equipping your mind with what statesmen should be equipping their mind with. If you look at our founders and you look at the reasons why they were able to form the country, the form of government they did, and the nature of the government they did, you will see that most of them, if not all of them, were ardent and passionate students of human nature. They were students of philosophy. They were students of jurisprudence. They were students of theology, most of them. And so they spent and were very dedicated to understanding the principles and the precepts of natural law and also sociological law or psychology. And they were able to equip their minds with just about any scenario, any situation they could encounter. I think that's what we're missing today. I think most people do not want to think in that depth of an understanding. They don't want to discipline themselves to read stuff that they may find boring or irrelevant to their life, when in fact it is those types of matters that are the most crucial to our understanding. And so I think people, maybe like J.B. Williams, have sort of bought into the just the modern cultural understanding of the way we understand politics, which for the most part, again, is very shallow. It's very short snippets of little phrases that they'll throw out there to try to get to capture people's emotions, to try to capture the sort of irrational side of our minds, as opposed to using the statesman's form, which is objective, which is based in reality, and is based on principles of the Constitution as we've ratified, as well as human nature. So that's what I see as being one of the problems that could, if addressed properly, if people began to look at things in that manner, we would have enlightened minds, and we would have people who would have more of a clear vision of the direction we need to go and where we've gone wrong. And, you know, the only thing we can do is just help people see that light. And the more we do it, I think the more people will see that light. But as long as you got people throwing out stuff the way J.B. Williams did, if they're listening to that kind of shallowness, then we've got more work to do.
Well,
thank you, Tim. I greatly appreciate that.
I just totally affirm everything you just said. We've got about 13 minutes left, and again, I'd love to go to the spiritual battle, but I think right in line with what we're talking about, and particularly with their attacks on Ron Paul's foreign policy. You wrote an article regarding turning the page of a decade of war.
Yeah, that article. I was actually asked to be on Lars Larson's show the day I wrote that article. And if you listen to Lars Larson, you probably already know that he's very much in line with the let's go to war and let's send our troops all over the place to try to protect America. And so I wrote that article sort of in anticipation of being on his show that night. And the way I laid the article out was sort of, I wouldn't say it's sarcastic, but, you know, here we've been sending troops to God knows where for the past 10 years, and we've spent literally over $1 trillion in doing that. And, you know, thousands and thousands of soldiers have died. Families' lives have been ruined. Marriages certainly have been damaged. Children have been damaged. The soldiers coming back have been damaged. And so we went through a decade of that. And now all of a sudden, you know, Obama gets up and says, well, you know what? We've been successful in our war. It's time to cut back because we don't have the money to continue sending troops and all the money we have to use to sustain that kind of an operation worldwide. And so the article was essentially, and let me just add, and then Obama said that day that, you know, we're going to have to start setting precise goals for the military and start setting the boundaries of our operations and this sort of thing. And so my simple response was, you know, if we would have done this to begin with in 2001, which would have required a compliance with the Constitution to begin with, meaning either one, declaring war against an identified enemy, or two, declaring letters of reprisal whereby a small operation could have been launched to identify the enemy and to destroy the enemy if we knew who they were. But the way it was done, of course, as we know, was it literally was this sort of like we're trying to dig out the enemy, we're trying to find the enemy, we're going out there, and we are, as George W. Bush said, we're going to find all the terrorist networks around the world, and we're going to destroy any government that's supporting the terrorist networks there was no end to it. There was no parameters or any direction that would have limited this war. And so what ends up actually limiting the war is simply our lack of money to continue it. And that's the reality that the founders identified with a war that is not declared and with a war power given to the president with no boundaries set forth by Congress. And so that's exactly what we experienced. And, meanwhile, our economy is down the tank, down the tubes. People are suffering. Millions of homes foreclosed. Millions of people have no jobs, no income to support their family, yet we're spending $1 trillion to send troops all over the world. So the article was a sort of anticipation of what I anticipated Lars Larson's position to be that night, which I was correct. So, it's just another one of these issues we're having to deal with when we're discussing constitutional limits on government and trying to bound our government to make sure that if there are powers that they are using, that they're using them not only constitutionally but wisely and prudently, so that, they're not destroying American lives in the process.
Well, this is precisely where I thought you were kind to J.B. Williams, because I knew that there was an awful lot more that you could have said, and I guess in my heart of hearts I wish you had said, because I knew about your other article, I knew what your attitudes were about it, and I know what Ron Paul is trying to do, and let's look at this, and what's different about the Bushes and Obama and all of the other GOP candidates that are different from Ron Paul? This is precisely where he differentiates himself. He's not going to get sucked in to these hidden agendas, control of oil. I've been trying not to get into the word Luciferian, because I think we need to talk about that another time. But the point is that there's these agendas that are going on out there that have fraudulently, and we've been sucked into all of these wars and all of these conflicts throughout the whole history of our nation, going all the way back to the founding time. And they've rewritten the history. And right now, there's not a lick of difference when it comes to this issue of any of these GOP candidates and the Bushes and Obama. They're all in the same boat. And the only one that's really got any sense about this is Ron Paul, and they're calling him dangerous. You got about 7 minutes to address that.
Yeah. Well, the ironic thing about our situation, our political situation, is that Ron Paul's position on foreign entanglement and making sure we do not step outside the parameters, not just talking about the Constitution, but also talking about the laws of nations. When we step outside that parameter, it has nothing but bad consequences for generations to come. And that's exactly what George Washington warned us about, as well as other presidents and other statesmen before and after the U.S. Constitution was ratified. And Ron Paul's position is more in line with that ideological underpinning of a free society in America than any of the other Republican candidates. And, of course, President Obama is just carrying on that same sort of ideological, the war spreading ideology. So it's very just ironic that these people would say that Ron Paul is, dangerous to the United States. In fact, Gingrich even said that Ron Paul's foreign policy was dangerous to America. And yet, under the Bush and Obama administration, while they're out sending troops all around the world, we have the southern border virtually open to anybody that wants to come across, and we know that there are terrorists coming into the United States through that southern border, and yet we're not even spending the time and the resources we need to secure that border, and our military is off around the world, not even here to protect the United States at home, and they're saying that Ron Paul is dangerous to the United States. It's just their rhetoric is it's self-condemning when you look at the policies that these people promote, both domestically and regarding foreign affairs. And when you actually compare their philosophy with the philosophy that the Enlightenment philosophers expressed, it's contrary to that founding philosophy as well. So, you know, we've come a long way in the United States, in the Republican Party, and, you know, it's frustrating because you see the major media not giving credit and merit to Ron Paul where he actually deserves it. So Ron Paul's movement is literally a grassroots movement. It's literally a movement of the people, and it has nothing to do with major media or major political parties or anything like that. These are people, by and large, who want freedom. They want government to be bound by the Constitution. They want the states to have their due authority to exercise that, and for the individuals and families to be able to govern themselves in peace. And so if this movement will not die with Ron Paul, even if he's not nominated, you know, we have people out there who are carrying on the movement, including us here, and we're not going to let it die. It will continue to grow.
Tim, one of your fellow Montanans, who is a good friend of Walls in Our Minds, and just wrote in our chat, her name is Jan, and she goes by Jan MT. So she wrote in that he is only dangerous to the UN, Fed Reserve, and New World Order.
Yeah.
We've also got online with us Kurt McKenzie of Defend Rural America, and Kurt has a question for you, Tim.
Okay.
Tim, I actually met you and your dad and Mike and Sue of Liberty Bell back in Kalispell back in summer last year. I dropped in a couple of the meetings there. You may recall I'm the guy that wrote a book on the monetary system called Money Defending Your Prosperity. I just wanted to give you basically an open-ended question if you want to talk about the governor race in Montana and what's going on in Montana. I know that your dad is paired up there to run with Robert Fanning. Robert Fanning will be running for governor, and your dad will be the lieutenant governor. You want to take a moment and talk about that?
Yeah. Bob Fanning and Chuck Baldwin are running for governor and lieutenant governor of Montana. There's 9 candidates right now in the race on the Republican ticket. And so it's an open primary, and it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. You know, Bob Fanning and Chuck Baldwin are running on a strong constitution platform. They are, they're considered to be the Ron Paul candidates of Montana. So you have a lot of libertarian, a lot of strong conservative Republican, and even a lot of the Democrats who believe in lesser government are supporting this campaign. So it's going to be interesting because a lot of the other candidates are very much of the same mold. There's not much difference among them. And so certainly Bob Fanning and Chuck Baldwin have a very distinctive quality about them. And so we need people who believe in this message of freedom and responsibility and liberty to help support them. If your listeners want to learn more about them, they can go to their website, which is fanning-baldwin.com. That's F-A-N-N-I-N-G, fanning-baldwin.com. They can learn more about that. And I guess if your listeners want to, you know, you've mentioned a couple of times about the spiritual issues. I know we can talk about that later, but just for your listeners' sake, I wrote a book on Romans 13, The True Meaning of Submission, that your listeners may be interested in obtaining a copy of that book, because it talks about the church's and Christians' role within society and relative to government, and it refutes this idea that we are to submit to government no matter what, and we must just lay down and obey regardless of justice and those other things that we must consider as free people. And so they can go to Romans13truth.com for that. It's Romans13truth.com.
Well, we are down to less than a minute to go here. I just want to give you any final comment, Tim, that you'd like to make in the 30 seconds.
Thank you for having me on your show. I appreciate it. we have a lot of work to do. This is a day by day, and it's not a quick fix. This takes diligence. This takes hard work and effort on our part to ensure that we protect and preserve freedom. We must study it. We must learn about it. We must know how to apply it. And then we must get out into our counties, our states, in the federal level, and get the right people in office. That's what it's going to take. And unless we do that, then we really don't have a right to complain. We've got to get out there and do our parts. That's how God made us. That's how God made the world. We can't sit back and just let things happen. We must till the soil. We must plant the seeds. What if the armies
of the Lord? Thank you very much, Tim, and I will be in touch with you. I'd love to have you back next week on Thursday night if you're available, because I really believe the spiritual battle is important, and would like to devote the show to that. Red, good night. Kirk's already gone. I think Karen's already gone. Kate, thank you very much. See everyone next week on Thursday night with Walls and Our Minds.
What if his people